This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the United States government has been trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela for most of this century. But the ruling Socialist Party keeps getting elected by the people in ballots that international observers have repeatedly said are among the freest and fairest in the world. Venezuelans last month voted to keep President Nicolas Maduro in office. The Black Alliance for Peace sent human rights activist Ifeah Wangaza to observe the election, and we'll present her full report.
But first, dictators have come and gone in Africa, but only one of them, Uganda's Yoweri Museveni, has been in power for 32 years. Museveni was Ronald Reagan's favorite African strongman, and Museveni's military has been a tool of U.S. policy in Africa ever since. The Ugandan army has wreaked havoc among its neighbors, destabilizing Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and intervening in South Sudan's civil war. Last month, a coalition of Pan-Africanist organizations came together with a campaign to expose the Ugandan regime as a menace to Africa. It's called Stop Museveni. Milton Alamadi, the publisher of New York-based Black Star News and a native of Uganda, explains.
Museveni needs to be stopped, because this one individual has caused so much havoc, not only in Uganda, but in the entire East and Central Africa region in the 32 years that this Western U.S. and UK-backed dictator has been running that country, essentially on behalf of foreign Western influence, not on behalf of Uganda. On behalf of Western interests, as well as Museveni's own personal interests and his family, because he's phenomenally enriched himself and his family and U.S. and British and other corporations have benefited from his rule, even though it's come at tremendous human cost.
When you look at the map, Uganda is a relatively small country on the African scale. And yet, you say, its leader, Museveni, has wreaked havoc in the entire region.
Absolutely, because he has essentially usurped the entire budget for military purposes. So he has the most well-equipped military in the region, even though the schools have collapsed. The hospitals have collapsed. There's no medicine. People die of the most simple, basic diseases. Women die while giving birth. Women who die while delivering in Uganda is the highest incidence in the entire East and Central Africa region, because he spends all the money essentially on himself, his family, the elite that help him sustain power, as well as his personal family. So therefore, as a result of this, his army, which supposedly was not able to defeat the ragtag insurgency of Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, was nevertheless able to invade Rwanda in 1990, exacerbate ethnic tensions between Hutu and Tutsi, and then overthrow the government of Rwanda under President Juvenal Habyarimana in 1994 and ignited what is now called the Rwanda genocide, when the plane carrying President Habyarimana and the president of neighboring Burundi, Cyprien Ntaryamire, was about to land in Kigali Airport, that plane was shot out of the sky. And reportedly, this is in fact, according to an article in the New York Times, which is a paper that has been extremely friendly to Museveni, reported that the missile was supplied to the Rwanda Patriotic Front out of U.S. stockpiles that had been seized. The U.S. had seized these missiles after it defeated Saddam Hussein's invasion in Kuwait and gave those surplus missiles to Uganda. Museveni then gave it to the RPF. That assassination, that double assassination, as you know, has never been independently investigated by the United Nations because the U.S. has blocked it. Uganda then subsequently invaded the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was then Zaire. The initial invasion by Uganda, by Rwanda, which then supported the insurgency of Laurent Kabila, was actually relatively very popular because it managed to overthrow dictator Mobutu. But thereafter, Uganda then remained as an occupying power in Democratic Republic of Congo. Ultimately, Laurent Kabila was assassinated. Uganda and Rwanda escalated their role. In fact, the two armies of Rwanda and Uganda fought battles inside Congo over who gets to control the spoils, the resources of eastern Congo. And as you know, both Uganda and Rwanda are not industrialized countries, meaning all those mineral and natural resources are plundered and then exported to the UK, to United States, to Canada, and some other countries where they are used in the factories in the industrialized country. So it means that Congo was not a victim only of Uganda and Rwanda, but it was actually primarily victim of these Western countries who actually enabled and supported and condoned the Ugandan occupation of the Congo, which, as you know, has caused the deaths of anywhere from 6 to 7 million Congolese. Nobody even knows the precise figures anymore.
Yes, some have characterized Uganda and Rwanda collectively as hitmen in Africa for the United States. And both of these countries also contribute heavily to so-called peacekeeping missions with their militaries.
Absolutely. So essentially, these armies of these two countries now serve the same role that Mobutu and his army used to conduct in the 1970s and the 1980s. Mobutu would deploy his army with the support of Morocco, but ultimately with the financing of France, the U.S., in order to try to undermine the liberation struggle in African countries. So in other words, in Angola, it would support first Holden Roberto, and then later on, Jonas Savimbi against the MPLA, which was, of course, seen as anti-West because it was not a tool of the U.S. and Britain during the liberation struggle. And the same role was played by Mobutu when it came to the liberation struggle in what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and the same thing in Mozambique. So today, Museveni and Kagame are armies for rent on behalf of Washington and London. So Museveni has deployed anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 Ugandan soldiers in Somalia. But look, there have been many reports that this is not an effective peacekeeping mission for a number of reasons. It is exclusively, almost exclusively, Uganda deployment, and it's being misrepresented as an African Union deployment. If it was an African Union deployment, it might have been much more efficient. It would have represented perhaps included countries like South Africa, like Ghana, like Nigeria, major African countries with stable and relatively democratic governments, meaning the Somalians may have actually cooperated with the deployed troops. But the people in Somalia, except for the government that is sustained in the capital, Mogadishu, people in Somalia see Uganda as an occupying force in Somalia. That's the first part. The second part, it's been well documented that the Ugandan military has actually been selling weapons to Al-Shabaab, which is the supposedly terrorist army in Somalia. Why would Uganda do this? Because Uganda benefits tremendously so long as this conflict continues in Somalia. It receives funding from the United States and the EU countries. And the money which is supposed to be deployed to this intervention force is actually embezzled by the military and political elite in Uganda. So Uganda has a vested interest in keeping this conflict going on in Somalia. That is why it's lasted for more than 11 years. Uganda has deployed for 11 years, and there's no indication that Somalia is any closer to peace than before Uganda was deployed 11 years ago.
And it is generally understood, including by the U.S. corporate media, that the Somali so-called peacekeeping operation is actually run by the CIA.
Absolutely. And that has not actually been well exposed in the so-called mainstream media. And I always refer to them as so-called because if we refer to them as mainstream, it means we're almost accepting the fact that what they represent is actually acceptable to the mainstream. And it should not be, because they actually provide the cover that countries like Uganda under the Museveni dictatorship or Rwanda under Kagame need by ignoring these stories or covering them partially and not including or providing the critical elements. So, for example, in the United States, Mugabe was widely resented by Americans that hardly knew anything about Africa. Mugabe was demonized. Yet, in fact, the most destructive African leader of the 20th and 21st century has been Yoweri Museveni. 1 million Ugandans have died as a result of the concentration camps that he created in the northern part of Uganda for 20 years. He used the cover of the war with Joseph Kony to actually exercise retribution against the Acholi, whom he perceived as being unwilling to submit to his rule. And then, of course, after depopulating a large part of that region, he then handed over the land that once was occupied by the peasant farmers to members of the political and the military elite. It was because of Uganda's invasion of Rwanda in 1990 that ultimately we saw what is characterized as the Rwanda genocide of 1994. It is because of the multiple invasions of Congo by Uganda that we've seen millions of Congolese lose their lives. And the most recent invasion, of course, was Uganda's invasion of South Sudan in December 2013. Instead of trying to mediate the conflict between President Salva Kiir and his vice president, Riek Machar, Museveni intervened on behalf of Salva Kiir and, according to Human Rights Watch, used cluster bombs, which is internationally banned. And yet, there was not a word by the United States, by Britain, or by any member of the Security Council, any of the permanent members of the Security Council. So therefore, we see that these Western so-called powers, as well as the corporate media, are in cahoots, and they've actually enabled and abetted Museveni's destruction of the East and Central African region.
Clearly, Museveni is a serial aggressor, although, as you say, the United States has smiled upon him since the days of Ronald Reagan. Back in 2005, as you point out, the World Court, or the International Court of Justice, awarded the Democratic Republic of Congo $10 billion from Uganda. Uganda was supposed to pay that for its aggression against the Congo. But Uganda has just ignored that ruling.
I'm glad you brought that out. The $10 billion awarded by the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, in 2005, was for what amounted to crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. As a result, not only of the destruction of property, the plunder of resources, but the loss of lives and the brutal massacres carried out against the people of the Congo. This is the interesting part that then followed. And now, by the way, that $10 billion, not a dime, has been paid. And the Congo, which could easily enforce that judgment, has not made a move. Because Joseph Kabila, the current illegitimate ruler of the Congo, as you know, his term expired in December 2016, actually also served the interests of both Kagame in Rwanda and Museveni in Uganda. That's why he has not moved to enforce that judgment, and Uganda has not paid. Uganda has diplomatic missions and owns buildings and properties all over the world. A legitimate Congolese government could easily enforce that judgment and get international lawyers to help it enforce that judgment. Obviously, it would be very damaging to Ugandans. But I believe at a future date, a legitimate government in the Congo would recognize that this was not an aggression by Ugandans, but an aggression by Museveni, and work out an amicable arrangement. But for the time being, so long as Museveni targets and brutalizes the Congo should actually exercise that option and would have been within its legitimate rights to seize all Uganda properties that are overseas, and to actually investigate and see whether it could actually also seize any interest of any Western company that is doing business with Uganda. So, for example, recently, General Electric, GE, signed a deal, a multi-billion dollar deal, to build an oil refinery in Uganda. The people of the Congo should explore their legal options, whether they can actually initiate action against GE.
So what form is this Stop Museveni campaign going to take here in the United States and elsewhere? You say that it's going to be a multi-year and multi-dimensional campaign.
Absolutely. And I want to thank the Pan-African Unity Dialogue for joining us and helping to mobilize and being an integral part of this campaign. The Pan-African Unity Dialogue, founded by Professor Ron Daniels, is an alliance of Pan-African organizations, African, African-American, Caribbean, and Latino, meets on a quarterly basis and strategizes and selects campaigns to mobilize and carry out campaigns against issues that affect the collective African global community. And because Museveni's militarism has been detrimental to so many countries in Africa, millions of people in Africa, this was one of the campaigns selected by PAUD to target. In addition to the protest in front of Uganda's diplomatic missions in the United States and around the world, we are going to be educating the public. We're going to try to deliver the information that the corporate media does not deliver to the public. There's a very powerful film called A Brilliant Genocide, which was made by an Australian film director, Ebony Butler, and it really details the atrocities committed by Yoweri Museveni's military in the northern part of Uganda, over a 20-year period from 1986 to 2006, when he confined 90% of the population of that region, or 2 million people, in the concentration camps. We've been screening this, and it's been very effective. After each screening, people in the audience want to know what role they can play in the Stop Museveni campaign. We screened it at John Jay College. We screened it at Columbia University. We screened it at the Brooklyn Commons. We screened it at the New York Bar Association. And we'll be happy to screen it with any entity, church, school, or any other organization that contacts us and asks us to do the screening. And then we're going to, of course, be mobilizing the U.S. Congress. We're going to primarily start with the Congressional Black Caucus and then go to other members of Congress and the Senate as well. We want them to screen this documentary, but ultimately what we want is an arms embargo against the regime of Yoweri Museveni, because the weapons being supplied, and the U.S., by the way, give the Museveni regime more than $1 billion a year of U.S. taxpayers' money, financial as well as military support. So we're asking for an arms embargo. The weapons sent to Uganda is not being used to protect the citizens of Uganda. It's not being used to protect the citizens of any African country where Uganda has deployed its armed forces.
And I would think that inevitably the Stop Museveni campaign would also be a Stop Paul Kagame of Rwanda campaign, since they are often partners in crime.
Absolutely. And that is the double role that this campaign will play. Because as you have noted, Kagame actually used to be a part of the Ugandan military, as you know. He was chief of Uganda's military intelligence up till the October 1, 1990 invasion, when essentially thousands of members of the Ugandan military, many with ancestry in Rwanda, were allowed to invade Rwanda from Uganda with the full logistical support of Yoweri Museveni. And that war lasted for 4 years and created the conflagration, which has not yet actually ended to this day in the entire region.
So it is Kagame and Museveni that have bathed that part of Africa in blood.
Absolutely. On behalf of Western interests, because the desire or design was to displace French influence from Rwanda. And that was actually accomplished. It was done. It came at the cost of up to 1 million lives in Rwanda and anywhere from 6 to 7 million lives in the Congo. That was the cost of displacing French influence in Rwanda by Kagame and Museveni on behalf primarily of the United States under the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton.
The U.S. corporate media, acting like mimics of the U.S. government, has been slandering Venezuela ever since newly elected President Hugo Chavez declared that his country would stop taking orders from Washington back in 1998. The United States has been trying to overthrow his government ever since. Over the last 20 years, Venezuela has held more elections than any other nation in the hemisphere, possibly the world, all of them certified by global observers as free and fair. But the U.S. corporate media continues to claim that the Socialist Party government of the current president, Nicolas Maduro, is illegitimate. The Black Alliance for Peace sent an observer, veteran human rights activist Afia Wangaza, to the latest election in Venezuela last month. She reported back on a call-in program last week, hosted by Black Agenda Report's Margaret Kimberly, who's also part of the Black Alliance for Peace.
Hi, everyone. This is Margaret Kimberly. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us, joining the Black Alliance for Peace discussion and report back on the Venezuela election observation process. Afia Wangaza attended the election. She was one of the election observers at the request of the Venezuelan government, which has been welcoming people from all over the world to see their process. And we're going to get started. I am here tonight as a BAP, Black Alliance for Peace, coordinating committee member. I'm going to introduce Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu is the national organizer and the national spokesperson for the Black Alliance for Peace.
The Black Alliance for Peace, of course, is only a year and 1 month old. We are in the process of building. This is a grassroots, bottom-up movement made up of individuals and organizations. We see this as a part of the effort to not only rebuild the traditional Black anti-war, anti-imperialist opposition of the Black liberation movement, but we see that as a very important part of attempting to help to revive the anti-war movement here in the U.S. We are working on a number of things right now. We want to just very briefly talk about the fact that we are part of a new coalition, the No U.S. Foreign Bases Coalition. We launched this coalition, I think, officially in January in Baltimore. And that coalition basically is a coalition that says what it's all about. We are going to struggle and fight to put pressure on the U.S. state to close all U.S. foreign bases, bring those troops out of these territories, and let's say that $150 billion and bring that back to address the material needs of people in this country. We are developing work around linking that global perspective, that internationalist perspective, with work domestically dealing with repression within the U.S. And we're looking at developing the work around stopping the Israeli training of police forces, of dealing with this 1033 program that's transferring military equipment to these increasingly militarized police forces. We are working very hard to develop a campaign to divest from the military, working with groups like Code Pink in that area. So we are developing work. We are developing work around closing the bases in Africa also, of course. But we are mainly attempting to provide these kinds of educational programs as we prepare folks for the kind of fight that we know we have to engage in, because it's quite clear to those of us in the Black Alliance for Peace that the U.S. state is prepared to fight to the last drop of your blood and mine in order to maintain the hegemony of this backward system. We know that they are more dependent than ever on violence and war and the permanent war agenda. And we are just as determined, in fact, more determined to deny them our blood, our support. And so we've got to organize and struggle to, in fact, do that. So we're bringing this program this evening, and we hope that you join us. If you are of African descent, you can definitely join this alliance. And I'm sure that no one who believes in the autonomy of Black leadership and self-determination has a problem with that. If you are non-African descent, you can join as a supporter of this alliance. So please consider doing that. Consider continuing with your generous support. As we said already, we come to you for support. We get no money from foundations. We only come hat in hand to the people. So we hope that you can take some time after this call to go to our site, join if you're not a member, but also to give and give as generously as you can.
As Ajamu said, we're relatively new. We were formed in 2017 on April 4th, and that date, of course, is not accidental. It was the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's speech at Riverside Church when he decisively broke with the Johnson administration and declared his opposition to the war in Vietnam, a very significant date. You will see the many statements we've released. We've been very busy in just over a year. May 25th was Africa Liberation Day, and we released a statement that not only demanded an end to AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, and the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Africa, but we also called upon others to do the same, the Congressional Black Caucus and leadership of the Poor People's Campaign.
To finish up, for the Black Alliance for Peace, we see Venezuela as a key nation state, not only in the so-called Americas, but in the world. It's part of this process of power being shifted away from the powers that make up the pan-European capitalist colonial project back to the people. And because of the key role of Venezuela as a country that is providing and provided much needed assistance to liberation groups and to other states like Cuba, Venezuela has been in the crosshairs of the U.S. state for quite some time, but it was a concentrated effort to begin to really destabilize the state a few years ago toward the latter part of the Obama administration, and that process has only intensified under Trump. So we're happy to have been able to send an observer, a key person, someone who is a longtime freedom fighter, Ifeel Wangaza, a SNCC organizer, a member of MXG, the director of the Malcolm X Center in Greenville, South Carolina, someone who's always been at the center of resistance here in this country. And we're so happy she had a chance to go down to not only represent the Black Alliance for Peace, but in many ways to represent the Black Liberation Movement.
Good evening, everyone. I want to first thank the Black Alliance for Peace for the honor and privilege of representing the Alliance and for the opportunity to serve the people of Venezuela. There were 400 observers from around the world, governmental and non-governmental in status, and the Electoral Commission of Venezuela was transparent, cooperative, and accommodating in their effort to ensure that observers had full and complete access to every aspect of the electoral process. In fact, as soon as I saw the corporate media in the U.S. began its propaganda campaign, I launched what I call my Don't Believe the Hype, and saying that if the people in the United States were so fortunate as to have such an electoral process, use such a model, we would be fortunate. There is a great deal to be learned from the Venezuelan process. My experience reaffirms the observations of former President Jimmy Carter, and that is, to quote him, that the Venezuelan system is the best in the world. I was particularly impressed with, first of all, the ease with which people in Venezuela could access the electoral process. As we know, here in the United States, there are all forms of gerrymandering going on, from attempting to prevent people from being able to get the necessary identification or voting card, to once folks show up at the polls themselves, the surprise of not being on the voting rolls, the surprise of the machines not working properly, or the surprise, among others, of machines working, but machines not being available. Here in South Carolina, we have the problem of machines that have no paper trail. So when complaints are made that one candidate was selected and another candidate's name appeared, there is little or no way to actually appeal that inconsistency. I was particularly impressed on our first day. We went through the actual material technological aspect of the election, from the pieces, the physical pieces that compose the various machines, to the software which processes the vote, the fact that the software, first of all, belongs to the government, as is not the case in the United States. Secondly, that it was developed in partnership with engineers from Venezuela with engineers in China who developed the machines and the software under the supervision of Venezuelan engineers. Secondly, that the checks to prevent double voting, for lack of a better term, or misvoting by persons other than the named recognized person on the list. And the only thing one needs in order to be able to vote at one's proper polling place, which is normally within walking distance of one's home, is the national identity card, which everyone receives when they are 9 years old. And there have been suggestions, of course, in this country that folks should be able to get voting cards, and not when they're born, then certainly when they're 18, the same as males are required to register for the military. The checks include not only a photograph of the voter, but also fingerprints, two fingerprints, the thumb and a second finger of his or her choosing, and third, one's signature. The final step in the process of certification is an actual inked thumb, which with indelible ink, which doesn't wear off for a number of days. So the ability to go back and vote a second time is pretty much eliminated. I was also greatly impressed by the television campaign, where, like commercials in this country for candidates and other commodities, there was an ongoing campaign called Vota Venezuela, which not only encouraged people to vote, but also set out each step in the process for voting, including the machine, the ballot, the receipt that each voter receives at the end of the process, which is then placed by the voter in the ballot box and counted at the end of the evening, but also what one might need to do if a question arose at the polls, which is, of course, in this country, a great mystery as to what we're to do if we show up at the polls and our names have been removed for some bogus reason, ranging from having been declared a felon to any number of other imaginary reasons. I was further impressed by not only the easy access of voters to the voting booths, but the helpfulness of the folks at the polls. And at the polls, there were representatives from the various parties in order to monitor and to make whatever complaints that they felt needed to be made. I was further impressed by the fact that the assistance that seniors and disabled persons received from younger people, the intergenerational interactivity that existed, the assistance that was an organization that was provided by the Citizens Militia, which in this country the equivalent would be in most places a block captain who would provide assistance and give information. The quantum and quality of printed information that was available, from simple flyers that again described the voting process, that gave instructions as to what folk needed to do if there was they had a question, who to contact, how to contact them, and where to go if a problem arose. Not only were the machines easy to use, but the ballot itself, which not only had the names of the parties, the political parties, but had the picture of the person that the party had endorsed and was supporting. when that party line was chosen, that line actually lit up to assure the voter that his or her vote was being properly allocated, which, as I've said here in Greenville in particular, we've had instances which have gone unaddressed where folk have voted for one candidate and somebody else's name shows up. The enthusiasm of the folk in Venezuela, while there may be some criticism that the number of voters was not as great as in past situations, the enthusiasm of the folk who showed up and their determination to vote was impressive. In fact, it rather reminded me of 2008 in this country when folk persisted and voted for Barack Obama. I would remind folk that there was an attempt to organize a stay away or a boycott of the election, and despite that, the turnout was significant. In fact, it was close to what is the normal voting numbers or percentage for the United States, which by comparison of other industrialized countries is considered to be low. The U.S., by comparison, is 26 out of 32, or was 36 out of 22 in 2016. We'll see what the new numbers wind up being for the midterm elections here. However, consistently, the United States trails most developed countries in voter turnout. I was also impressed by the willingness of the voters to talk to and answer questions of any of us, including journalists who were able to speak with them, especially in Spanish, for them to answer whatever questions they were asked, and we were not limited to contacts with voters once they had voted, especially, nor were we limited in the kinds of questions or number of questions that we were able to ask. So people spoke quite freely about their concerns and their recognition of the fact that the country is under assault. They recognized that, one, that the United States and other Western countries have a history of going for the resources, and in the case of Venezuela, oil, of the resources of the people, and that when that is not made available to the West, generally the United States in particular, then the United States is given to bullying. They have a great relationship with Cuba. When we went into various neighborhoods, not only were there medical clinics that were staffed by Cuban medical personnel, but persons trained by Cuban medical personnel. I was particularly impressed with the housing development campaign that is going on. They've built over 2 million new housing units in Venezuela, and that campaign is an ongoing focus in order to improve the quality of life of the Venezuelan residents. The literacy rate is estimated at between 90 and 100%. I didn't get a chance to check what the United States is in order to make that comparison, but we all know that it's significantly lower than that. The relationship with Turkey was an informative and surprising one. Turkey has pledged to produce a significant number of housing units in Venezuela and building their relationship, strengthening their relationship along with China and Iran. So as far as the electoral process, reflects the needs and the will of the people. Following the election itself, we were able to attend the announcement of the result of the election. And it wasn't projections as we get in this country. It was the actual numbers that of votes cast, because when the vote is cast, it goes directly to the central counting center. In addition to that, it was a public announcement with both the radio and television presentation, graphics to support them, and an opportunity for questions. The next day, we were able to spend time with the commissioners of the Election Commission to ask questions and to have them to address the concerns that were raised with regard to implementation of the various demands that people had raised during the interviews held in the course of our observing the election. There was significant concern about the possibility of violence, so the military was readily available, so not intimidating, and kept its distance. The representatives kept their distance from the polls and the polling place so that people did not appear to feel uncomfortable with them. I was struck by the fact that in Caracas, not only is there a reliable, reasonably priced public transportation system, buses and subways, but I'm anxious to report that to the local city and county of Greenville, which seems to have, despite the fact that it's the fifth fastest growing city and county in the United States, seems to have great difficulty in providing those services here in the wealthiest country in the world. I think I'll stop here, and whatever questions folk might have, I'll be happy to answer.
We are going to go into questions now, and I'm going to use the moderator's prerogative, if I may, and ask the first questions. There's so much to cover. But I wanted to talk about what we're told here by the corporate media about Venezuela, about there's a food crisis, and there is, but it's created by sanctions. There's no mention of the destruction, the destructive force of sanctions, which are war by other means, against this country. Can you tell us, Sophia, about sanctions and the impact they're having on Venezuela?
The sanctions are, in fact, having a severe impact, and we know how deadly they can be, just referencing the 500,000 children under the age of five who were murdered by the U.S. government sanctions in Iraq. The Venezuelan government has programmed in order to buttress the poorest people in Venezuela against the ravages of the sanctions as it relates to food. Unlike the reporter from CNN, Kelly, whatever her name is, who claimed that she saw people digging in the garbage for food, I saw no such instances. And we were all over Caracas, downtown Caracas, the outskirts of Caracas. I don't know if it would certainly appear to be what we would consider the county or rural and quasi-rural areas of Greenville. The government has put in place a system, food distribution system, which ensures that the poorest neighborhoods receive food, fresh fruits, commodities that are a part of the regular dietary staple, and essentially forcing folk who have resources to access the outlets, the grocery stores, the stands, to use those resources for those purposes. So while, like the rest of the world, we don't always get what we want, folk are getting what they need, especially children and elders.
Thank you, Afia. So we're going to open to questions. It looks like Nellie is first.
Yes, I have two short questions. With respect to the sanctions, what impact has, in its some time now, 5 years since Hugo Chavez's death, the economic integration under the ALBA agreement for the states and the nation states within the region to, in part, counter any of the meddling, including economic meddling of the U.S. in Venezuela? And secondly, could you talk a little bit more about the opposition, because the U.S. corporate media played up the potential of violence that the U.S.-backed opposition, I can't think of any other way to describe it, would in fact try to foment some kind of chaos or havoc in the election to give the appearance of it not being a fair election?
Well, as you know, with regard to your first question, there is a U.S.-supported group called the Lima Group, which immediately stepped up to repudiate the results of the election. However, I don't see them as having the kind of credibility necessary for other countries to discount them, to discount the election, rather. I think that those countries that are committed to self-determination were moved and impressed and emboldened by the outcome of the election, which brings me to your second question with regard to the use of violence, the fermenting of violence by the U.S. in order to undermine not only the election, but to continue to strengthen or deepen the sanctions. The disability to access financial institutions and the parts and equipment necessary in order to upgrade and maintain the oil industry seems to be the most effective measure available at this time. However, my understanding is that Iran, as well as China, but especially Iran, is stepping up its support with regard to the oil production and distribution. Why the opposition chose to attempt a stay away or boycott as opposed to continued violence, I think, reflects the futility of the use of violence. One of the commissioners noted that while a great deal of emphasis has been put on lack of commodities, medicine in particular, available to the general population, that there's still 6 million Colombians who are living and staying in Venezuela as compared with the 200 or so Venezuelans who have sought entry into Colombia. So the resistance that the United States has attempted to ferment has not had the effect that it thought, that it sought, and is further reason for their tightening the sanctions. It was interesting that on Saturday I was able to use a credit card for transactions, and then on Monday, I was not.
Next one is Andrew.
My name is Andrew. I'm from Workers' World Party. Hi, hello to Afia, who I was there with. I completely agree with everything she said. One of the most important things that Ministry of Venezuela recommended was to fight to end the blockade. So it's one of the urgent tasks that we're facing. We have a new youth anti-war formation in Baltimore called Youth Against War and Racism. And I bring this up because both Workers' World Party, Youth Against War and Racism, and People's Power Assembly are co-sponsoring an action outside of the OAS on either June 4th or June 5th to protest the expulsion of Venezuela from the OAS. I was wondering if Black Alliance for Peace would co-sponsor such an action.
it definitely sounds like an action that the Alliance would be in support of. So we would probably want to communicate with you some more directly and get more information, and we'll talk about the process, how we, in fact, can get on board.
Next on stack is Saladin.
The social movements, how present were they during the elections, the trade unions, the youth movements? Were they very visible around the polls, in the streets, et cetera?
There was some visibility, but it was low-key. And the reason is because there is no campaigning for the last 15 days before the election. And it's very strictly enforced. We did attend one rally in one of the neighborhoods, and it was rather circumspect in that no candidates' names could be called or any parties could be promoted. So I think that, as I said earlier, the enthusiasm with which people appeared at the polls, their readiness to talk to us and to journalists, and there were all kinds of journalists. There were print journalists, TV journalists, a part of the delegation, is a better indicator of the enthusiasm than what we would think of whether they had. You couldn't wear T-shirts around the polls and carry signs, or because all campaigning ends 15 days before the election.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.